Okay, how many of you brought your Bibles? Hold them up so we can all see. If you're visiting with us, I want you to know we come to study our Bibles and we bring our Bibles. Thank you for bringing your Bibles this morning. We were all about halfway here. Our car was blocked in this morning. Our daughter is visiting with us, so we jumped in her car and came. And about halfway here, Janice said, "Ken, I've got to go back and get my Bible." I said, "I'm sorry, we're too close." But anyway. So, Matthew 5, 1 through 12. How many of you want to be happy? Let me see your hands. Let me see how many people want to be happy. I'm serious. Get your hands up if you want to be happy. If you want to be happy. Then if you really do want to be happy in the way that Jesus prescribes here, which is a happiness that is totally unaffected by your environment, then you're going to have to forget everything that you think you know about happiness. Really. If you really want to have the kind of happiness that God offers you, then you're going to have to forget what you know about what it takes to be happy. You see, happiness is not an illusion, but it is a paradox. That means something that seems to contradict itself. Let me give you an example. Which is better, sorrow or laughter? If you've read the Old Testament, you probably know the answer to that. But if you're a product of our society, then you know that certainly laughter is a lot better than sorrow. But Ecclesiastes, a wise man, said in 7:3, sorrow is better than laughter. And then he tells you why. Because sadness of the countenance makes the heart better. Do you understand that? If you don't, then you probably won't understand the Beatitudes. But hopefully we at least understand it a little bit, if not totally. And if you don't understand this concept, then you'll never know the true happiness until you understand the principles of the Beatitudes. There are two fundamental truths behind the Beatitudes. And I'd suggest that you remember these. You might have to jot them down. Two fundamental truths. The first one is misery is the key to happiness. And that may be a little bit of a harsh way to say it, but you tell me how you would say it. When he said happiness is being poor in spirit, mourning, meek, hungry, and persecuted. Sounds pretty miserable to me, doesn't it, to you? Everybody knows that happiness is being wealthy and independent and famous and popular and beautiful and powerful and smart. And Solomon was, we can say them together, wealthy and independent and famous and popular. And I don't know about beautiful, but young and smart. He had all these things. And we think to the degree that you, none of us have all these things. But the more of them you have, the more likely it is that you're to be happy, the world says, doesn't it? But somehow people at the very height of their popularity and strength and all of these other things take themselves out of the world. And that causes us to wonder what maybe it's really all about. And Solomon had all these things and he said the sum of it is emptiness. Emptiness. And the second fundamental truth behind the Beatitudes is you cannot fill a spiritual need with anything physical. Luke 12:15, a man's life does not consist of the abundance of the things which he possesses. And it's ridiculous to think that you can fill the void in your soul with junk manufactured by the world. If you're miserable, really miserable in your marriage, then go out and buy a new car. If you're unhappy, then go buy some new clothes or a new house or take a trip or make some more money. Luxuries have been known to do more to discomfort the soul than to salve it. Ecclesiastes 5:13, riches are kept for the hurt of their owners. So there's two principles behind the Beatitudes. Misery is the key to happiness, and you cannot fill a spiritual need with anything physical. And so this morning I want to at least touch on, and that's all we'll be able to do, is touch on the Beatitudes. And I know that you think, what can this guy tell me about the Beatitudes? We've studied them, you know, dozens and dozens of times. And maybe nothing, but maybe it's all a reminder. But what I want to do is I want to show you how they all tie together and how they all build on one another. And maybe they'll become more meaningful to you. He starts out, blessed are the poor in spirit. You see, the Greeks had two words for poor. One of them was, if you'll allow me, kind of regular poor, and the other was beggar. Guess which word this is? This is the beggar word. He says, blessed are those who are beggars, not on the outside, but in spirit, on the inside. This is the foundation for all the rest of the Beatitudes. Everything else is built on this. Isaiah 66:2, but to this man will I look, even to him who is poor and of a contrite spirit and trembles at my word. And if you want to see a biblical picture of what a spiritual beggar is, you remember the story that Jesus told in Luke chapter 18 of two men who went to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee, the other was a tax collector. You remember how he described the tax collector after the Pharisee got up and he said, God, I thank you, I'm not like other men. I do this, and I'm not like that guy over there. And he went down to his house satisfied with himself. He justified himself and he felt good about himself. And he got, when he went to church, he left with what he came for. But when the tax collector prayed, it says he stood at a distance. He would not so much as lift his eyes up unto heaven, but he smote himself on the breast and he said, God, be merciful to me, literally, the sinner. God, be merciful to me, the sinner. Now there is God's picture of a spiritual beggar, somebody who realizes that inside, I don't have anything to offer you, God. I'm not good. I'm not righteous. I'm not holy. I'm not lovable. And when we recognize that, like this man did, he wouldn't even lift his eyes up. He wouldn't be so arrogant as to lift his eyes up to heaven. But he beat himself on his breast, and he just asked for mercy. The song, Rock of Ages, says, nothing in my hand I bring. What? Simply to thy cross I cling. I don't have anything to offer, God. The point, what does a beggar have to offer? I mean a real beggar. Nothing. He can't do anything for you. He can't offer you anything. And he says, blessed are those who recognize that you don't have anything inside to offer God. Theirs, literally, alone. Theirs alone is the kingdom of heaven. Doesn't belong to anybody else. Now, here's the second one. Blessed are they that mourn. And we've always had lots of classes about this. And we've said lots of things about mourning and mourning for people who, for our loved ones who've died. There are actually nine verbs that are used that are translated the word grief or mourning. And this particular one happens to be the strongest one. And though it's true that there are many valuable lessons to be learned from sorrow, as we saw originally when we began, Psalm 126:5 says, they that sow in tears will reap in joy. He's not talking about physical sorrow. He's not talking about sorrow over circumstances. He's not talking about mourning at the loss of your husband or your wife or your mother or your father. He's not talking about circumstances of this world, but he's talking about sorrow over sin because you recognize that you are a spiritual beggar and you have nothing to offer God. You're deeply mournful in your soul. And you know, there, when we recognize that we're, when we truly recognize that we're spiritual beggars, what can we do but mourn? There's four ways to deal with your spiritual bankruptcy. This is a sermon within itself. Number one, you can deny it and put on some kind of an act. and that's called hypocrisy. Or you can admit it and try to do something about it yourself, and that's called legalism. Or you can admit it and despair so much that you commit suicide like Judas did, and that's hopelessness. Or you can admit it and repent and turn to God for grace and mercy, and that's called Christianity. And the blessing for those who mourn is they alone will be comforted. And can't you hear Jesus saying to those who are mourning, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid of the storm. Don't be afraid of sickness. Don't be afraid of dying. Don't be afraid of anything. Fear not. They alone will be comforted. And then the next one, and notice how they build on one another. Blessed are they that are meek. And interestingly, this comes from the same root word as the very first one. The first one said, blessed are the poor in spirit. And this word meek comes from the same root word. Sometimes they're used interchangeably. But here, and I want you to really listen to me. Here, the first one, poor in spirit, centers on my sinfulness, my spiritual beggarliness. But this one, meekness, centers on God's holiness. When I realize how spiritually bankrupt I am, then I can do nothing but mourn. And then the reasonable thing is to look at God's holiness. And in view of God's holiness, I'm incredibly meek. And that's the opposite of argumentative. It's a person who's pliable. It's a person who's moldable. You see how these things build on one another? And the blessing is they alone will inherit the earth. And conventional wisdom says you got to stand up for your rights. You got to fight for what's yours. If you're going to come out ahead, then you're going to have to get tough in this life. But conventional wisdom never does understand spiritual wisdom. God's wisdom says be kind, be gentle, because after all, one day I'm going to give it all to you anyway. You don't have to fight for it. You don't have to stand up for your rights. I'm going to give it all to you anyway. They alone will inherit the earth. And then following that and building on that, blessed are they that hunger and thirst after righteousness. You see, these things don't stand independently of one another. And we're just kind of laying a foundation maybe for a whole quarter study sometime. But these things build on one another. And when you develop this attitude of meekness, pliability, then the natural thing is for you as you look to God and you're incredibly meek in God's presence and in view of your spiritual bankruptcy, then you begin to starve for what God has to offer. You want more than the breath that you breathe to have the blessings that God offers in your life. You see, the first two, poor in spirit and mourning, that's my attitude about me. The next two, meek and hungering and thirsting after righteousness, is based on my attitude about God. And they build on one another. You'll never have the attitude of meekness and hungering and thirsting after righteousness until you have the proper view of yourself. And that's the first two. There's pain in those first two. And they reach out for balm that God offers. Hungering and thirsting after righteousness. And the blessing is they alone shall be filled. And we need to ask the question, filled with what? Righteousness. They alone will be filled with God's righteousness. Justification is righteousness. It's how God makes you righteous. And we long for that sanctification. It's how God keeps you righteous, not imputing our sin to us, as Paul will say in Romans chapter 4, verse 7 and 8. And then building on that comes some actions. Merciful. Mercy is compassion in action. And you see, the Roman society viewed mercy as a weakness. I can remember as a kid, 18-year-old kid, going to work on an offshore drilling rig, and a guy fell out of the off the stabbing board up here. Had finished a well, and they brought in a casing crew. And one night, about 2 o'clock in the morning, this guy was standing on this board about 40 feet up, and he was trying to break a nut loose with a big wrench, and he couldn't do it with one hand, so he let go and he grabbed it with both hands, and it slipped off and he fell out backwards, and he hit on the small of his back on a drill bit that was standing up on the floor of the platform, and he broke his back. And they came, I was just roustabouting and I was asleep, and they came and woke me up and said, "Do you want to go home?" And I said, "Why would I want to go home? I don't get off until 12 o'clock tomorrow." And they said, "Well, we got a guy hurt. We got a helicopter coming out. We need somebody to ride into New Orleans with him." So I said, "Well, yeah, I'll go." So I got up there and threw all my stuff in my little ditty bag and got up there on the heliport waiting for the helicopter. And this guy, they can't give him any kind of pain medication because he's broken his back. And so he's in extreme pain. They got him in a little wire litter with a little piece of cloth in it. And he's laying there and everybody's standing around, nobody's talking to him, and this guy's laying there. And so I go over to him and I kneel down beside him, and tears are running out of his face, as you might expect. And he grabs my hand and he just squeezes really tightly, and he said, "Am I going to die?" And I said, I'm thinking to myself, I don't know if he's going to die or not. He might, but I don't know what to say to him. And he just was looking at me pleadingly. And so I said, "No, you're not going to die." And he said, "Well, how do you know?" And the only thing I could think of to say, "Well, it's too far from your heart." Well, so I said, "It's too far from your heart." And, he seemed to be comforted by that. And I guess he was grasping for any straw. So, but I remember a line that when I hired on out there, one of the things that they told me is, "Leave your pity at the dock." And that's a pretty sad way to live, folks. Leave your pity at the dock. I couldn't leave my pity at the dock. I didn't know anything, but I had to, what little I had to offer, even though it was ridiculous, I guess, at the time, I offered it. Blessed are those who are merciful. Roman society said, "Leave your pity at the dock." And even Jewish society, the adulterous woman, they didn't have any pity on her, did they? And even people who were sick, you remember the disciples asked Jesus when they saw the crippled guy, they said, "Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born this way?" We leave our pity at the dock if we're not careful, don't we? And people deserve what they get. Mercy causes you to meet the needs of others as best you can. You see, mercy deals with felt needs, or trying to remove or reduce consequences. Now, grace goes further than that. Grace removes not just the consequences, grace removes the problem. But most of the time, we can't remove somebody's problem, but we can help them some with the consequences, maybe. If nothing more than holding their hand and saying, "You're not going to die." He said, "Blessed are the merciful," those who put that compassion in action in their life. And he says, they alone will be shown mercy. James 2:13 says, they who have shown no mercy will be judged without mercy. Happiness is. This is what happiness is. Being merciful to others. And then he says, blessed are the pure in heart. Don't you hate dealing with agendas? Don't you hate dealing with someone who's hypocritical about maybe caring for you or why they're doing something, and you take them at face value, and before long you learn they're working you? They've got something that they want from you, or they want to accomplish through you. Don't you hate those kind of things in life? Blessed are the pure in heart. Don't you hate the things of this life that enslave you? After having sinned so grievously with Bathsheba, David cried out to God, "Create in me a clean heart." Oh God, we read that this morning, didn't we? "Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew a steadfast spirit in me. How can I have a clean heart? Because my life hasn't been clean. How can I have a clean heart? Well, God forgives us. We become His children. And John 15:3 says, now you are clean because of the Word. And so we must get in the Word, get in God's Word. It works in our lives. And the blessing is, they alone shall see God. And obviously, that doesn't mean that we're not going to see God as judge. Every man, every eye is going to behold Him as judge. But we're going to get to see God in all of His splendor, in all of His beauty. And then He says, blessed are the peacemakers. And peace is an interesting word. If you live in the East, I guess you can say that peace is the absence of war. But that's not really peace, is it? And a truce is not really peace. A truce just says, I won't hit you if you don't hit me. And that's not really peace. Now, it's better than war, but it's not really what peace is all about. Peace, true peace, requires reconciliation. And the only ones who can make peace are those who have peace within themselves. You cannot truly be a peacemaker if you don't have peace of God within your heart. And the result of all this in Matthew chapter 5, you would think if somebody lived this way and had all of these things in their life, then you would think that everybody in the world would love them, wouldn't you? But you know better, don't you? You know Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. He says the result of all this is you'll be persecuted. And happy or blessed are you when people insult you and persecute you and falsely say all kind of evil against you because of me. You see why I say you've got to forget everything that you think you know about being happy. This is a completely different kind of happiness. It is in no way contingent upon what's happening on the outside. It's all about what's on the inside. And that's what the Sermon on the Mount is about. Righteousness is from the inside out. Righteousness has to do with what's on the inside. It's not just what you do. It's kind of like my friend and I were building something one time, and I heard this just deep, and I looked over and he had hit his thumb with the hammer. You've been there, right? And for, I think, probably a full minute, neither one of us uttered a sound. And he just sat there with his eyes closed holding his thumb. He had really hit it hard. And there wasn't anything I could say. You know, anything you say at a time like that is not good. So we're just real quiet. And after about a minute, he took a deep breath and he looked at me and he said, what you think doesn't count. But you know what? What you think counts more than what you say. It really does count. What you think counts the most of all. And for the moment, we may not be able and often are not able to control what we think for the moment. But for the long haul, we can, can't we? And that happiness that Jesus offers here, that He's talking about, depends on us controlling what we think and what's on the inside. And that's a lot harder than controlling what's on the outside, isn't it? I mean, we can get to the point that we don't say the word. But to get to the point that we don't think it and hold on to that thought is a real challenge, isn't it? And then verse 10, he says, happy are you when people insult you and so forth. And then verse 11 is an expansion. He says, verse 10 says, blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. You would think that somebody who did these things wouldn't be persecuted. Somebody who was meek, somebody who was a peacemaker, somebody who was pure in heart, somebody who hungered and thirsted after righteousness, you would think they wouldn't be persecuted, wouldn't you? But you would think wrong. You would think wrong. The world has to make you pay if you look better than it does. It has to somehow bring you down, and so expect these things. Tertullian, one of the early church fathers, tells of a man who came to him having just become a Christian, and he said, well, I've become a Christian, But now I don't know what to do about my job. I don't think that Christ would approve of my job, but I must live. And Tertullian looked at him and he said, "Must you?" Bottom lines. These are bottom lines that we're talking about here in the Beatitudes. Jesus concludes his sermon, "Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Happiness. We all want to be happy, but we're going to have to forget everything that we think we know about happiness. Really. And you know, as I look out over this audience, it just really, as I prepare this lesson, I think, I wonder how many people will really take this seriously. I wonder how many of us just really deep down in our heart think we know better about how to be happy. And we just have to get some more stuff. We just have to get some more new things, or we just have to whatever. But if you really want to be happy, go back to the very beginning. Blessed are the poor in spirit. And then begin to build your life deliberately on these things that he's telling us this morning while we stand and sing.